Welcome to the Moore Lectureship. It's appropriate that this lectureship, provided by a woman benefactor of this institution in honor of her parents, is offered, and that we have a patron and benefactor of the church and the scholarly community to fill that lectureship today. Beverly Gaventa is Associate Professor of New Testament at Princeton Theological Seminary. She has studied at Phillips University in the great state of Oklahoma and at Union Theological Seminary and Duke Divinity School. She has received an honorary degree from Kalamazoo College and many other academic honors. She's the author, a distinguished author, of many books and articles in the field of New Testament. One of her books, From Darkness to Light, Aspects of Conversion in the New Testament, was published in the mid-80s. And she also has a very important place in the scholarly world of New Testament study these days, as she is a leading member of the Society for Biblical Literature, chairing its Committee on Research and Publications. She's one who edits collections of critical book reviews in the field of religion. She is a person of the church representing her denomination, the Christian Church Disciples of Christ, on the World Council of Churches Commission on Faith and Order. I've heard former Dean Elizabeth Nordbeck of this institution come home from World Council Church, of Churches meetings telling about the hijinks of Beverly and herself. She's currently at work on a commentary on the Book of Acts, a book tentatively entitled The Maternity of Paul, fascinating title, and a work called Mary, the Mother of Jesus. And it is that work, I suspect, which spawns the paper which she will give us today, Disciple, Prophet, and Mother, Glimpses of Mary in the Gospel of Luke. In Romans 16, Paul writes these words: I commend to you our sister Phoebe, a deacon of the church at Cenchreae, that you may welcome her in the Lord as is fitting for the saints, and help her in whatever she may require from you, for she has been a benefactor of many, and of myself at well. That's the New Revised Standard Version translation of that verse. In one of her scholarly works, Beverly Gaventa has written these words: Paul describes Phoebe as a deacon of the church of Cenchreae and a benefactor of many and of myself as well. Although Paul writes at a time prior to the official establishment of church offices, the fact that Phoebe is a deacon, not deaconess, as the Revised Standard Version erroneously translated, surely means that she serves in some significant leadership role in that congregation, that she is a benefactor, or better, patron, and not helper, as the old RSV erroneously translated, signals that Phoebe is a person of some wealth and power, and that she has used those assets on behalf of Paul and other Christians. And so, in the spirit of Paul, I commend to you our sister Beverly, a scholar and teacher of the Ecumenical Church, that you may welcome her in the Lord, as is fitting for the saints, and help her in whatever she may require of you, for she has been a patron and benefactor of many, and of myself as well. Beverly.
Thank you very much, Bob. I was beginning to get a little nervous. I was afraid some of Elizabeth's stories were going to be told. That would certainly not be a good idea. We'll have to check signals and see how much of the truth she actually told. And you do suspect right. I am going to talk this morning based on the work that I've been doing on Mary in the New Testament. In 1978, a panel of scholars, both Catholic and Protestant, published a book called Mary in the New Testament, in which they characterized the Lucan Mary as the first Christian disciple and as a model for disciples. They found Luke's treatment of Mary consistent from its beginning at the Annunciation to its end in Mary's appearance with the 11 in the upper room in Acts 1. Since that volume was published, Raymond Brown and Joseph Fitzmyer, in their commentaries on the birth narratives and the Gospel of Luke, respectively, have elaborated on the notion that Luke's consistent presentation of Mary is that of an ideal disciple. In Brown's words, Mary responds obediently to God's word from the first as a representative of the Anawim. She appears in the ministry of Jesus as a representative of the ideals of true discipleship, and she endures till Pentecost to become a Christian and a member of the church. What I want to suggest this morning, contrary to Brown and Fitzmyer, is that Mary takes on not one, but three distinct and interrelated roles in Luke Acts. At times, Luke portrays Mary as one of the disciples, perhaps even as an exemplary disciple. In the Magnificat, however, she also serves as a prophet, one who has been inspired by God to proclaim what God is doing among the people. Finally, and not least, Luke describes Mary as a mother, and it is in connection with this role that she contributes an important element to the dramatic tension at the beginning of Luke's narrative. The claim that Luke portrays Mary as a disciple draws heavily on the first scene in which she appears, the Annunciation. Because I am generally in agreement here with the interpretation, the conventional interpretation of that scene, I'm going to comment on it very briefly. The Annunciation to Mary, as is widely acknowledged, parallels the Annunciation to Zechariah, which comes just before it. And, of course, both of these scenes parallel and draw heavily on Annunciation stories in the Hebrew Bible. But it's important to notice the ways in which Luke also contrasts Mary's story with the story of Zechariah. For example, Luke carefully explains how Zechariah and Elizabeth deserve the blessing they are to receive. Zechariah is a priest. Both he and Elizabeth are upright and blameless before God. Gabriel asserts that Mary has found favor with God, but the reasons for Mary's blessedness are never given. Zechariah and Elizabeth are both old and have waited in vain for a child, in contrast with the young Mary, whose motherhood presumably awaits her marriage to Joseph. The two stories of Zechariah and of Mary also differ in their conclusions. The Annunciation to Zechariah culminates in silence, but the Annunciation to Mary culminates in her consent, which I would translate as, "Behold, the slave of the Lord. Let it be to me according to your word." Mary claims for herself the title, "Hei doule kuriu." Now, the RSV translates doule as handmaid, and the NRSV as servant. But they're softening translations. There can be no doubt that what the word means is slave, whether we like it or not. Mary recognizes with the statement God's selection of her and the compulsion under which her role will be played. To translate as handmaid or servant girl is to leave open the possibility that Mary has chosen this role when everything in the story makes it clear that she has not. She has been chosen. The difficulty with the title slave of the Lord for Mary arises precisely because generations of Christians have seen Mary as a model or example for all women, and have distorted, by a curious chemistry, her slavery to the Lord to mean the subjection of women in general to men in general. But that sort of misinterpretation of the text does not, in my judgment at least, give us license to make the text into what it is not. The title, "Slave of the Lord," indicates the authority of God in human salvation and says nothing about the authority of men and women in relationship to one another. On the contrary, if Mary is God's slave, then she cannot, at the same time, be the slave of a human being. The rest of this first of verse 38, Mary's statement, indicates that she consents to the calling. Let it be to me according to your word. Mary has not chosen this task for herself any more than the apostles will later choose their own roles. But she does consent. With these words, she becomes not a model female, but a model disciple who consents to what she cannot fully understand. That is a role Mary will play again in Luke Acts, but as the story goes, it is not the only role she takes. Now, the scene changes with Gabriel's departure, but Mary remains the focus of the narrator's attention. Indeed, her actions set the stage for what follows. According to the narrator, she set out, she went with haste, she entered, and she greeted. What Mary enters is the house of Zechariah, recalling for us once again his plight, that is, he has been rendered dumb because of his question of the angel, and again contrasts his unwillingness to hear with Mary's willingness. Luke sets him up as a foil for Mary, emphasizing once again her obedience and his own continuing inability to speak. That inability on his part is eloquently echoed by contrasts with both Elizabeth and Mary, each of whom bursts into spirit-inspired speech. A friend of mine says that Elizabeth and Mary are only permitted to talk when Zechariah is shut up. Which, an interesting concept that we might consider using more often. Although Mary enters Zechariah's house, her greeting addresses Elizabeth, and it prompts Elizabeth's statement about Mary. Elizabeth's outcry reinforces the portrait of Mary already emerging in Luke, but it voices that portrait quite differently than did Gabriel. Each one of Elizabeth's statements addresses Mary as a woman, and especially as one whose maternity is a sign of God's blessing. Where Gabriel said, "You have found favor with God," Elizabeth cries, "Blessed are you among women." With the phrases, "the fruit of your womb," "the mother of my Lord," and "the child in my womb leapt for joy," Elizabeth's words draw attention to the reality of both pregnancies and the joy that accompanies them. While Gabriel's statements, both to Zechariah and to Mary, focus on the future greatness of John and Jesus respectively, Elizabeth's cry attests to the inbreaking of the Spirit at the present time. Elizabeth's closing words praise Mary for her confidence in the promise that was made to her. Taken together with Mary's consent to the words of Gabriel, these closing words offer our only hint, our only clue to why Mary may have been said to have found favor with God. Or better, since the declaration of Mary's favor with God precedes her act of consent, these words characterize her response to the favor bestowed upon her. The Magnificat begins with the abrupt introduction, "And Mary said." The speech itself is a veritable collection of texts from the Hebrew Bible. But in the Lucan context, it is Mary who gives voice to these words. Her situation interprets the Magnificat. And in turn, the Magnificat reveals something of who Luke understands Mary to be. Whatever the history of the Magnificat or the sources behind it, here it serves as Mary's interpretation of events. And our question is what it reveals about her. In the words of praise that introduce the Magnificat, Mary's haste to reach Elizabeth takes shape in words. The first section of the Magnificat gives reasons for the praise of God, beginning with God's regard for the low estate of his slave. Because this statement echoes that of Hannah in 1 Samuel, commentators sometimes worry about the fact that Mary is not barren and her predecessor was. But this is a too literal reading. It overlooks the connection between the doula of the Magnificat, the slave of the Lord, and Mary's claim of that title for herself. Her low estate may take a different form than did that of Hannah, who beseeched the Lord because of her own barrenness. But Mary, no less than Hannah, is to be identified with the poor, the powerless, as the rest of the Magnificat, indeed the whole of the infancy narrative, demonstrates. The form of Mary's low estate is here announced and will be explained in the lines that follow. The blessing that all generations bestow on Mary magnifies or extends the blessing already bestowed on her through the agency of Gabriel and the greeting of Elizabeth. What is new here is not the blessing of Mary, but its extent. All generations, not just Gabriel, not just Elizabeth, but all generations will regard her as blessed because of the one who has blessed her. In verse 50, Mary connects God's action in her own case with a prophetic motif of God's overturning things as they are. God scatters the proud, God puts down the mighty. The movement from God's blessing of Mary to God's action for all people isn't arbitrary. It interprets God's action in Mary's case as part of the larger history of God's acts of salvation for God's people. Interestingly, this passage anticipates the scene in Nazareth in Luke 4. It's not Jesus who introduces the motif of the good news in this gospel, but Mary, who sees in herself a specific example of God's salvation of the poor and the lowly. The closing lines of the Magnificat place it firmly within the context of God's covenant faithfulness with Israel. All that occurs does so in remembrance of his mercy, as he spoke to our ancestors, to Abraham and his descendants forever. The scene closes with the narrator's comment that Mary stayed with Elizabeth for 3 months and then returned to her home. Notice that phrase carefully avoids identifying Mary with anyone else's home. She has not yet gone to live with Joseph. We might have anticipated that Mary would return to the home of her father, but Luke does not say that. Whatever connections or identifications belong to Mary, for Luke she has importance exclusively as God's favored one. Given the way in which Mary has been viewed as the exemplary female, that sort of singular identification may lead us to become uncomfortable, to suspect that what's going to follow here is that women are significant only, once again, as they are wives or mothers. But Luke often reduces people to a single feature, as do many biblical writers. For example, he introduces Saul as the church's enemy in Acts, Peter as the church's spokesperson. That doesn't mean that these figures had only one dimension as historical figures or even in the life of the church, but that Luke chooses, out of all the stories that might be told, a particular feature to enhance as part of the overall design of his narrative. In the Magnificat, in fact, Mary's role changes from her role in the Annunciation. In that scene, Mary hears of her son's birth, and she consents to her role as slave of the Lord. Perhaps more than any other scene in the Luke and birth narrative, at the Annunciation, Mary functions as a disciple, as one who follows. During her visit to Elizabeth, however, she moves from being the object of Elizabeth's praise and becomes the prophetic interpreter of the gospel itself. Excuse me. Following Mary's return home, Luke narrates the birth of John and his subsequent circumcision and naming. The parallel scene with respect to Jesus that opens in 2:1 masterfully understates the importance of Jesus' birth. Like every previous scene in the birth narrative, Luke begins the scene of Jesus' birth by referring to time. Perhaps that's why I like Luke so much. He's as obsessed with time as I am. Here, however, time is not counted in terms of Elizabeth's pregnancy or the reign of Herod, but in terms of the Roman Empire. The opening reference to the time of Caesar Augustus and his decree threatens to overwhelm everything else in the story. Reinforcing that virtual eclipse of Mary's pregnancy is the order in which the characters appear in the opening lines of chapter 2. The weighty introduction of the person of Caesar Augustus, followed by the local ruler Quirinius, all who go to be enrolled in the census, and the lone man Joseph, may cause us for a moment to lose track of the anticipated parallel to John's birth. Indeed, the promise to Israel itself seems suddenly lost on the world stage, the story of Caesar. It is only when the narrator has reached the end of explaining Joseph's trip to Bethlehem that we learn that Mary went along for the ride. With the birth itself in verses 6 through 7, the narrator abruptly focuses on Mary. If we translate that just a little bit literally, more literally than you would find in the NRSV, it goes something like this. While they were there, the days of her pregnancy were fulfilled, and she gave birth to her firstborn son, and she swaddled him, and she lay him in a manger, because there was no place for them in lodging. Apart from the introductory notice about the time of Mary's delivery, and the closing notice about place, three active verbs describe these events, and in each case, Mary is the subject, and the babe is the object of the verb. Here, Mary acts alone. There is no word about bystanders. Even Joseph remains hidden from our vision. In this way, irony emerges in the story, as the seemingly ordinary, insignificant Mary gives birth to one more ordinary, insignificant baby within the larger context of Caesar's attempt to control the population by counting them. Abruptly, with verse 8, the narrator shifts again from Mary and her action to the scene of angels who reveal the good news of this birth to a group of shepherds, directing them to go and see the child. The response to the shepherd's story again places Mary in the foreground. Her response to the visit stands between two other responses to the visit and contrasts sharply with them both. Mary, Luke tells us, kept all these things, considering them in her heart. In the responses that surround that of Mary, there is at least the impression of a verbal exchange, maybe even a loud exaltation or cries of amazement and confusion. But Mary is silent. While all who heard marvel at what the shepherds told them, and the shepherds rejoice in what they heard and saw, it's not clear what causes Mary's response. The narrator doesn't explicitly connect her pondering with the coming of the shepherds, All these things that she considers undoubtedly includes their visit, but it may refer to earlier events as well. Perhaps most important, the narrator explains that those who surround Mary respond with amazement and awe, but the verbs that describe Mary's response connote neither wonder nor praise, but secrecy and even isolation. Where earlier her fear yielded to consent in the presence of Gabriel and even to praise in the Magnificat, here he leaves her response uninterpreted. Similar statements in the Hebrew Bible underscore the impression of ambiguity here. When the patriarch Joseph begins to dream of his future greatness, Jacob's response sets him apart from Joseph's brothers. But it is not clear what Jacob thought or feared about this troublesome son of his. Genesis 37 reads, "His brothers were jealous of him," that is of Joseph, "but his father kept the saying in mind." In another place in the book of Daniel, Daniel concludes the narration of one of his dreams with the comment, "As for me, Daniel, my thoughts greatly alarmed me, and my color changed, but I kept the matter in my mind." Now, these two stories don't easily parallel Luke 2, but the similar wording is used, and they may suggest that Mary's response is intended to be unclear. She understands some things, but much about this son and his future remains unclear and perhaps even troublesome. By means of that unclarity, Luke interjects a bit of narrative tension, both about who Jesus is and about where Mary's pondering will take her. This motif of not understanding begins with Zechariah, where it's part of the stereotypical response to the presence of the divine. And it continues when Mary reacts to Gabriel, but it takes on a slightly different texture here and later at the end of chapter 2, where no reassurance, no explanation resolves the story's tension. As Zechariah's prophecy follows the birth of John the Baptist, the prophecies of Simeon and Anna follow and further interpret the birth of Jesus. Luke sets the stage for this event by explaining that Mary and Joseph take Jesus to the temple in Jerusalem to present him to the Lord. The introduction of Simeon reports his credentials. Like Gabriel, Elizabeth, Mary, and the angel who addresses the shepherds, we know that Simeon can be trusted. Twice he speaks. In verses 29 to 32, he holds the infant Jesus and addresses God directly. Simeon asks to be released from this life because he has already witnessed in the person of Jesus God's salvation of Israel. In language that will echo throughout the book of Acts, Simeon describes God's salvation as a light for the revelation to the Gentiles and glory for your people, Israel. Even in its brevity, Simeon's canticle epitomizes the themes about John and Jesus that have emerged in the birth narratives. The canticle expands the scope of God's salvation to include the Gentiles, but otherwise there is nothing here that is especially unexpected. The parents of Jesus respond with the astonishment that earlier characterizes pronouncements about his greatness or John's greatness. In other words, within the story that has developed up to this point, Simeon's first statement is quite predictable. His second statement, however, introduces an element of foreboding that we haven't previously seen in the birth narrative. The oracle directly addresses Mary. "Behold," he says, "this one is destined for the fall and rising of many in Israel, and as a sign to be spoken against. Indeed, your own self a sword will pierce, in order that the thoughts of many hearts might be revealed. Simeon addresses this entire oracle to Mary, but the beginning and ending of it focus on the significance of Jesus and the role he will play. He will not be just a light to the Gentiles and glory for Israel. He will also be a scandal, a point of division. The important theme of the rejection of Jesus sounds its first note here. And this ominous note introduces a kind of dissonance against the otherwise joyous, triumphal tone of Luke's story. In the middle of this second oracle, an additional word addresses the future of Mary in particular. Indeed, your own self a sword shall pierce. Now, the long history of Christian reflection on Mary has produced a bewildering array of interpretations of this saying. Perhaps the one that best accounts for its immediate literary context comes from Raymond Brown. Drawing on the saying about a sword passing through the land in Ezekiel 14, and on adaptations of that saying in other Jewish literature, Brown argues that the saying refers to a discrimination, a division that lies ahead within Mary's family. The interpretation of the sword that pierces Mary as a sword of discrimination or division, as I said, fits the immediate context well. But the saying may well bear more than a single point within the overall story. Just as the saying about a light for the Gentiles has one meaning in Luke 2 and yet another meaning when we get to the end of Acts. This particular saying about the sword, with its vivid imagery of the piercing of Mary, surely at least hints at the pain the death of Jesus will cause her. Letters of consolation from the Greco-Roman period often employ the imagery of a sword when discussing the grief of mothers on the loss of their child. Seneca, for example, writes to his mother about her loss as a result of his own exile. He writes, "Of all the wounds that have ever gone deep into your body, this latest one, I admit, is the most serious. It has not merely torn the outer skin, but pierced your very breast and vitals." In another letter of consolation, Seneca uses the same image, "that you may know," he writes, "that even this deep cut wound will surely heal. I have shown you the scar of an old wound that was not less severe." These and other instances in which grief, particularly the grief of a mother, is compared with a wound, suggest that the piercing of Mary at least includes the pain involved at the death of Jesus. The foreboding element that enters the birth narrative in Simeon's oracle concerns both the resistance to Jesus that will eventually lead to his death and the implications of that death for Mary, his mother. In this scene, then, Mary acquires her third role. In addition to her earlier roles as disciple and prophet, here she takes on the role of mother, and it is here Luke calls her by that name for the first time. Of course, she literally becomes Jesus' mother when he is born, and the shepherd's visit finds her pondering the meaning of what has occurred, but it is here when Jesus' death is anticipated and her own grief is anticipated that she is given the title mother. The final scene in the Lucan birth narrative, the story of the boy Jesus in the temple, serves in part to show us, rather than simply to tell us, that Jesus does grow and mature in the eyes of God as well as of human beings. This final episode in the Lucan birth narrative also employs Mary to continue and even to enhance the narrative tension that has been introduced as Mary ponders in 2:19. and with the oracle of the sword in 235. Returning home from their trip to Jerusalem for the Feast of Passover, the parents realize that Jesus is not with them, and therefore they retrace their steps to Jerusalem. It is not accidental that this is a 12-year-old. I think it would work even better if he were 13 or 14. The actions of Mary and Joseph, referred to here by the collective title, his parents, their actions dominate the early part of this story. In 13 verbs, Luke has them as the subject, for it is Mary and Joseph whose actions constitute the movement in this episode. Apart from the reference to Jesus staying back in Jerusalem, every action in this story, up to their discovery of Jesus, is an action of the parents. It is they whom Luke has in his lens. The discovery of Jesus in the temple prompts two responses. First, those who are gathered there are amazed. Second, his parents echo this amazement with their own. They are overwhelmed. But it is Mary who speaks, her response being distinguished once again from that of others, even from that of the parents. Child, she asks, why did you act this way to us? Behold, your father and I have been looking for you in anguish. Often interpreters move quickly past this saying, and the reasons for that are not hard to imagine. There is some agreement that this entire episode of Jesus in the temple developed independently of the bulk of the Luke and birth narrative and was attached at a fairly late stage. As long as interpreters were primarily concerned with the history behind these stories and the history of the way the story itself developed, they seldom worried about Mary's puzzling question or revealing question. But the question plays a significant role in the whole of the Luke and birth story. In the first place, the question or question and assertion, where have you been? We've been worried about you. The question singles out Mary. As one of the parents, she has been actively seeking her son and now has found him. By identifying the comment as that of the mother, however, the narrator focuses on Mary and her son, all the more so since in a patriarchal culture it was the father who should have asked about the son. The statement, "Behold, your father and I have been looking for you in anguish," not only identifies their actions, it identifies their emotions. The birth narrative abounds in what we might call emotional responses to various angelic announcements, and hints at the pain Mary will feel at Jesus' death. But the emotional claim she makes here is of a different sort. This is not the stereotypical response of amazement in the presence of the divine, nor is it a foreboding, a fear about the future. This is the real, the present grief of parents who do not know where their child has gone. The RSV translates this, "Your father and I have been looking for you anxiously." That's not strong enough. Similarly, the NRSV says, "We've been searching for you in great anxiety." But some prominent instances of this, the usage of this verb adunun in the Septuagint, illustrate that it's a forceful word. In Tobit, for example, Tobias insists to his father-in-law that he must go home because my father is counting the days, and if I tarry a long time, he will be exceedingly grieved. There follows the story of Tobit's anguish over his son's delay and his mother's conviction that she will never again see him. Similarly, in 4 Maccabees, the widow who is about to be killed by Antiochus rejoices that her husband did not live to experience her own anguish upon watching the martyrdom of their 7 sons. Mary's comment to Jesus once again portrays her in the role of mother, a mother whose search is accompanied by nothing less than anguish. Mary's question and her rebuke of Jesus also introduce conflict into the story, as is evident from the fact that Jesus responds with a question, just as he will later on respond as an adult to interrogators who are hostile to him. He distinguishes himself from his parents by invoking his obligation to his father. And the question that he asks in no way answers Mary's concern. Indeed, it may even be a rejection of her question, perhaps even a rejection of her right to ask a question. The narrator's comment that they did not understand what he said to them reinforces the wedge this episode drives between Jesus and Mary. Like other episodes in the birth narrative, this one concludes with a notice about going away. Jesus leaves Jerusalem and goes away home to Nazareth with his parents. The final note that Jesus was obedient or submissive to them serves to alleviate somewhat the tension introduced by Mary's rebuke. But at the end of this episode, and as the end of the entire birth narrative, narrator provides two brief comments. The second is the comment about the growth and evaluation of Jesus, similar to that regarding John the Baptist earlier. But the first concluding comment concerns Mary and provides not a conclusion at all, but a kind of inconclusion. His mother kept all these things in her heart, not treasured, as the NRSV says, as if she wrote them up in the baby book, but kept. Since the return home brings an end to the temple scene, all these things refers not only to what happened there in the temple, but may include everything that has happened since the Annunciation of Gabriel. And unless we take this to be a very pedestrian comment about how Luke got his tradition about Jesus' birth, then the comment reflects the unfinished nature of what Mary has witnessed. Just as the story of the patriarch Joseph only begins when Jacob is said to keep things in his heart, Mary's story, Mary's act, is not one of memory alone, but of reflection and anxious anticipation. The narrator leaves quite unclear what exactly it is that Mary anticipates, and only by neglecting some important threads in the story can we assume that she anticipates Jesus' role with understanding and acceptance. Having read of her submission, her prophetic praise of God, the oracle about the sword that threatens her, her rebuke of Jesus and her inability to understand him, the reader will puzzle not only over Jesus and his future, but also over Mary. What will her eventual disposition be toward the child whose birth she accepted? Mary is, as Raymond Brown has commented, the only adult who appears in both the Lucan birth narrative and the Lucan gospel. But appear is the right word, since Luke refers to her directly in a single scene in the gospel and indirectly without using her name in one other episode. Neither episode discloses whether Mary is to be regarded as an insider in Jesus' circle or an outsider. We are simply reminded of her. Luke's second volume, the Book of Acts, refers to Mary only once. Following the ascension, Luke describes how the apostles return to Jerusalem and gather in the upper room. He then lists the names of the 11 and follows the list with a comment. All these with one accord devoted themselves to prayer, together with the women and Mary, the mother of Jesus, and with his brothers. With this brief reference to Mary, Luke resolves the tension that he introduced back in the birth narrative. Neither the sword that threatened her nor her own limited understanding have prevented her from becoming one of those at the upper room. That these are the ones who are faithful, there can scarcely be a doubt. Mary, who begins in Luke's story as a disciple, here also appears as a disciple. The resolution of the tension about Mary appropriately occurs at this point in Luke's overall narrative. Her unique place in the birth narrative carries over into Jesus' ministry and up to this time of transition into the church. But she does not play a role in the emerging church in Jerusalem and beyond. Nevertheless, as Luke portrays here the gathering and strengthening of the central members of the community, it is essential that he include Mary among that number. To draw this together, even in these short glimpses, and that's all we get, Luke presents Mary in these three distinct but interconnected roles. In response to Gabriel's annunciation of Jesus' birth, Mary is a disciple, even the first disciple. Her affirmation, "Behold, the slave of the Lord, let it be to me according to your word," signals her assent. If Mary is first and foremost a disciple of Jesus, that is not her only role. In the powerful words of the Magnificat, she also becomes a prophet. With its imagery of God's exalting the lowly and humbling the mighty, Mary's words recall prominent prophetic themes and anticipate those same themes in Jesus' sermon at Nazareth. Her third role, that of mother, appears to be her most direct and obvious, but in fact it emerges as the most complicated. Luke provides only a brief note about the birth of Jesus, the point at which she becomes his mother. The story scarcely glorifies Mary, since its focus everywhere is the baby rather than the mother. But at several points, Luke distinguishes Mary and her response to events from others who are also present. Mary is the one who ponders things that have happened. It is Mary who will be pierced. Thank you very much.